This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents When We Believed in Mermaids by Barbara O'Neill, performed by Sarah Naughton and Catherine Littrell. Chapter 1. Kit. My sister has been dead for nearly 15 years when I see her on the TV news. I'd been working the ER for 6 hours straight, triaging young humans from a beach party where a fight broke out. 2 gunshot wounds, one that nicked a kidney, a broken cheekbone, a broken wrist, and multiple facial wounds of various levels of severity. And that was just the girls. By the time we made it through the triage, I'd stitched and soothed the lucky ones. The unlucky ones were sent to surgery or to the wards. And I dived into the break room fridge for a Mountain Dew, my favorite way to mainline sugar and caffeine. A television mounted to the wall broadcasts the news of a disaster somewhere. I stare at it, sightlessly, as I gulp the sticky sweet soda. It's night. Flames are erupting in the background. People are running and screaming, while a news anchor with tousled hair and a vintage leather bomber jacket offers the news in properly grave tones. And there, right over his left shoulder, is my sister, Josie. For one long second, she looks at the camera, long enough that there is no mistaking her. That straight, straight blonde hair, cut now into a sleek bob that just grazes her shoulders, her tilted dark eyes and slashes of cheekbone, that fat Angelina Jolie mouth. Everyone always fussed over her beauty, and it's that combination of dark and light, angles and softness that does it. She's an exact mix of our parents. Josie. I feel as if she's looking through the screen, right at me. And then she's gone, and the disaster keeps going. I stare, open-mouthed, at the empty spot she left, holding the Mountain Dew out in front of me like an offering or a toast. To you, Josie, my sister. Then I shake myself. This happens all the time. Anyone who has lost somebody they love has experienced it. The head in the crowd on a busy street, the person at the grocery store who moves just like her, the rush to catch up, so relieved that she is actually still alive, only to be crushed when the imposter turns around and the face is wrong. The eyes, the lips. Not Josie. It must have happened to me 100 times in the first year, especially because we never found a body. Impossible, given the circumstances. Also impossible that she survived. Not for her the ordinary demise of a fiery car accident or a leap off a bridge, though she threatened those often enough. No, Josie was vaporized on a European train, blown up by terrorists. Gone, gone, gone. This is why we have funerals. We desperately need to see the truth for ourselves. See that loved one's face, even if it's marred. Otherwise, it's just too hard to believe. I lift the Mountain Dew all the way to my lips and take a long swallow of the thing we shared, this private reminder of all we were to each other, and tell myself it's just wishful thinking. When I leave the hospital in the pre-dawn stillness, I'm wound up, both exhausted and wired. If I want to get any sleep at all before my next shift, I have to work off the grimy night. Stopping by my tiny Santa Cruz house, 1,350 square feet on the edge of an almost not great neighborhood, I scramble into my wetsuit, feed the worst cat in the world his half can of wet food, and make sure to move my fingers around in his kibble. He purrs his thanks, and I pull his tail gently. Try not to pee on anything too important, huh? Hobo blinks. I load my board into my Jeep and drive south, not realizing that I'm headed for the cove until I get there. Pulling over into a makeshift space alongside the highway, I park and look down at the water. A few bodies out, not many at dawn. The water is Northern Cali cold, 53 degrees in early March, but the waves are lined up all the way to the horizon. Perfect. The trail starts where the sidewalk to the restaurant once was, and veers down the steep slope in a zigzag carved out a few feet away from the cliff where there used to be stairs. Our own private access to the isolated, hidden cove. The hillside is unstable, with a reputation for being haunted, and all the locals know it. I have the descent to myself, but then I know the ghosts. Midway down, I stop and look back up to the spot where our house stood, and the restaurant with its celebrated patio boasting the best view in the world. Both buildings lie in rotting planks and debris scattered down the hill, most of it washed away in storms over the years, the rest blackened by seawater and time. In my imagination, the buildings stand in spectral beauty, the sprawling Eden with its magnificent patio, and above it, our little house. Josie and I shared a room after Dylan came, and neither one of us ever minded. I see the ghosts of all of us when we were happy. My parents madly in love, my sister bright and full of boundless energy. Dylan, with his hair pulled back in a leather string, racing us down the stairs so we could build a fire on the beach and make s'mores and sing. He loved singing, and he had a good voice. We always thought he should be a rock star. He said he didn't want anything but Eden, and us, and the cove. I see myself, too, an urchin of seven with too much hair, whirling on the beach, the sky overhead blurring blue and white. A million years ago. Our family restaurant was called Eden, both exclusive and permissive, frequented by hippie movie stars and their drug dealers. Our parents were part of that world, too, stars in their realm, each wielding power on their own terms. My father, the jovial, welcoming chef, with his hearty laugh and excessive habits. My mother on his arm, a charming coquette. Josie and I ran around like puppies, sleeping on the beach of the cove when we got tired, underfoot and ignored. My mother was a great beauty who'd come for dinner with another man and fallen instantly in love with my father, or so the legend says. But if you'd known him, you would know it was entirely likely. My father was a massive personality, a charming, bigger-than-life chef from Italy, though people just said cook in those days, or restaurateur, which was what he really was. My mother loved him to excess, far more than she loved us. His passion for her was intense and sexual and possessive. But is that love? I don't know. I do know that it's hard to be the children of parents who are obsessed with each other. Josie thrived on drama the way my parents did. She had both my father's enormous personality and my mother's beauty, though in Josie, the combination became something extraordinary, unique. I can't count the number of times people drew and photographed and painted her, men and women, and how often they fell in love. I always thought she would be a movie star. Instead, she made of her life a great, ruinous drama, just like our parents, with a suitably catastrophic ending. The cove is still there, of course, even if the stairs are gone. I pull on my booties and weave my heavy hair into a thick braid. Light is spilling peach over the horizon as I paddle around the rocks and out to the line. It's only three others and me. A nasty shark attack a few weeks ago has thinned the ranks of the eager, no matter how badass the waves. And they are badass. Solid 9 feet, with a gorgeous glassy curl that's much rarer than people think. I paddle out and wait my turn, catch the line, and leap to my feet to ride right on the edge. This is the instant I live for, that moment when nothing else is in my head. Nothing can be. It's me and the water and the sky, the sound of the rippling surf, the sound of my breath, the edge of the board slipping along the water, cold over my ankles, even in booties, ice cold, perfect balance, shivering, hair slapping my cheek. For an hour, maybe more, I'm lost in it, sky and sea and dawn. I dissolve. No me, no body, no time, no history. Just the deck and toes, and air and water and suspension. Until it's not. The wave rips unexpectedly and so fast, so hard, that I'm slammed deep into the water. The washing machine of surging surf pounding my body, my head, the board, which tumbles too close, a dangerous power that could crack my head wide open. I go limp, holding my breath, letting the water suds me. Resistance will break you, kill you. The only way to survive is to let go. The world swirls up and down, around, for endless moments. I'm going to drown this time. The board yanks on my ankle, surges me another direction. Seaweed winds around my arms, swirls around my neck. Josie's face swims up in front of me, the way it was 15 years ago, the way it looked on television overnight. She's alive. I don't know how. I know only that it's true. The ocean spits me up to the surface, and I drag a breath into my oxygen-starved lungs. By the time I make it back to the cove, I am exhausted and fall on my belly onto the sand of the protected space, resting for a minute. All around me are the voices of my childhood, me and Josie and Dylan. Our dog, Cinder, a black retriever mix, romps around us, wet and smelly and happy. Smoke from the restaurant fires fills the air with a sense of cozy possibility, and I hear faint music weaving through long-ago laughter. When I sit up, it all stops, and there is only the wreck of what once was. One of my earliest memories is of my parents locked in a passionate embrace. I couldn't have been more than 3 or 4. It's unclear where they were exactly, but I remember my mother pressed up against a wall, her blouse shoved up, and my father's hands over her breasts. I saw her skin. They kissed so hungrily that they looked like animals, and I watched in fascination for 1 second, 2, 3, until my mother made a sharp noise, and I screamed, "Stop it!" The memory wafts around my mind as I sit down in my backyard an hour later, hair wet from a shower. I sip a mug of hot, sweet coffee and check the headlines on my iPad. Hobo sits on the table beside me, yellow eyes bright, black tail swishing. He's a feral, 7 years old. I found him when he was 5 or 6 months, starving, battered, practically dead on my back doorstep. Now he'll go out only if I'm with him, and he's never missed a meal. Absently, I stroke his back as he keeps an eye on the shrubs along the fence. His fur is long and silky, all black. It's remarkable how much company he provides. The disaster on the news was a nightclub fire in Auckland. Dozens of people were killed, some when the ceiling fell down on the revelers, some when fleeing partiers were trampled. There are no other details. With a rumbling sense of a train coming toward me, I click around the pictures, looking for the newscaster I saw last night. No luck. I fall back in my chair and sip some more coffee. Bright Santa Cruz sunlight shines through the eucalyptus tree overhead and makes patterns over my thighs. Too white, because I'm always in the ER or a wetsuit. It's not Josie, I think with my rational mind. I reach for the keyboard, about to type in another search term, and stop myself. For months after she died, I combed the internet for any possible clue that she could have survived the cataclysmic train crash. The explosion had been so severe that they couldn't identify all the individual remains. And as happens more often than first responders and law enforcement will admit, a lot of it was speculation. Your loved one was there. She has not surfaced. All indications are that she died. After a year, my twitchy need to search for my sister calmed down. But I couldn't help that catch in my throat when I thought I saw her in a crowd. After 2 years, I finished my residency at San Francisco General and came home to Santa Cruz, where I took a spot in the ER and bought myself this house not far from the beach, where I could keep an eye on my mother and build an ordinary, quiet life for myself. The only things I'd ever really wanted. Peace, calm, predictability. My childhood had been drama enough for one life. My stomach growls. "Come on, kid," I say to Hobo. "Let's get some breakfast." The house is a small, two-bedroom Spanish style in a neighborhood that crouches on the edges of places you don't want to walk at night. But it's mine, and I can be at the beach in 7 minutes on foot. I've updated the old appliances and crappy cupboards and repaired the splendid tile work. I'm thinking maybe pancakes for breakfast when my phone buzzes on the counter. "Hi, Mom," I say, opening the fridge. No eggs. "What's up?" "Kit," she says. A faint pause, enough to make me lift my head. "Did you happen to see the news about that big nightclub fire in New Zealand?" My stomach drops. Down, 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 all the way through the earth. "What about it?" "I know it's ridiculous, but I swear I saw your sister in one of the clips." Holding the phone to my ear, I look out the kitchen window to the waving fronds of eucalyptus, the flowers I planted painstakingly along the fence. My oasis. If it were anyone but my mother, I'd blow it off, run away, avoid opening this particular door. But she's done the work. Every step of AA, over and over. She's present and real and sad. For her sake, I take a breath and say, "I saw it too." "Could she really be alive?" "It's probably not her, Mom. Let's keep our heads, not get our hopes up, okay?" My stomach growls. "Do you have anything to eat? I was at the ER until 4, and there isn't a damn thing in this house." "How strange," she says in her droll way. "Ha, if you'll make me some eggs, I'll come over and talk about this in person." "I've got to be to work at 2, so make it quick. It's not even 11. "I am not putting on makeup," I say, which she always notices, even now. "I don't care," she says, but I know she does. It's walkable, another reason I bought in the area I did, but I drive so she won't fret. I bought her the condo a couple of years back. It's a bit dated, the rooms on the small side, but she has a wide view of the Pacific from the windows in the front room. The sound of the ocean keeps her calm. It's the thing we share, that hunger, bone deep, for the ocean. Nothing else will do. I climb the outside stairs to her second-story condo, looking automatically over the waves to check conditions. It's calm now. No surfers, but lots of kids and families playing along the edges of the softly ruffling water. My mom comes out to her plant-filled porch when she spies my car. She's wearing crisp cotton capris, yellow, with a white top striped the same sunny color. Her hair, still thick and healthy, blonde and gray, making it look streaked, is pulled into an updo like a young mom's. It looks just right, even though her face shows the hard years she's lived, all the sun-worshipping she's done. It doesn't matter. She's slim and long-legged and deep-busted, and the startling eyes have lost none of their jeweled brilliance. She's 63, but in the filtered light of her simple upstairs porch, she appears to be about 40. "You look tired," she says as she waves me inside. Vigorous plants of many kinds fill the rooms. Orchids are her specialty. She's the only person I know who makes orchids bloom over and over. Give her half a second, and she'll enumerate the various genus types. Cattleya, Phalaenopsis, her favorite. Delicate and beautiful Lilia, all with their proper Latin names. Long night. I smell coffee as I come in and gravitate to the drip pot. I pour coffee into the cup that's waiting, the one she saves for me. A heavy green mug with Hawaii painted across the front. Eggs and chopped peppers await on the counter. "Sit," she says briskly and ties an apron around her. "Omelet okay?" "Better than okay, thank you." "Open my laptop," she says, dropping a pat of butter into a heavy cast iron skillet. "I saved the clip." I follow orders, and there's the piece I saw the night before. The chaotic scene, the screams and noise, the newscaster in his bomber jacket, the face behind his shoulder, looking right into the camera for the solid beat of 3 seconds. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000. I watch, then rewind and watch again, counting. 3 seconds. If I stop the clip on her face, there's just no mistaking it. "No one could look that much like her," my mom says, coming to peer over my shoulder, "and have the exact same scar." I close my eyes, as if that will get rid of this problem. When I open them again, there she is, frozen in time, that uneven scar that runs from her hairline straight through her eyebrow and into her temple. It was a miracle she didn't lose her eye. "No," I say. "You're right. You have to go find her, Kit." "That's ridiculous," I say, even though I've been thinking the same thing. "How would I do that? Millions and millions of people live in Auckland." "You would be able to find her. You know her." "You know her too." She shakes her head, straightening her back stiffly. "You know I don't travel." I scowl. "You've been sober 15 years, Mom. You'd be fine." "No, I can't. You need to do this." "I can't run away to New Zealand. I have a job, and I can't just leave them in the lurch." I shove my hair off my face. "And what will I do with Hobo?" My heart stings. The job I can navigate, since I haven't had time off in 3 years. But my cat will pine without me. "I'll go stay at your house." I look at her. "Stay there or go in the morning and night and feed him?" "I'll move there." She slides the omelet, steamy and beautifully studded with peppers, onto the table. "Come eat." I stand up. "He'll probably hide the whole time." "That's all right. He'll know he's not alone. And maybe after a day or two, he'll come sleep with me." The smell of onions and peppers snares my body, and I dig into the eggs like a 16-year-old boy, my mind flashing up images. Josie bending over me to see if I was awake yet, her long hair tickling my neck when we were little. Her exuberant laugh, a flash of her throwing a stick for Cinder to chase. My heart literally aches, not metaphorically. A weight of memory and longing and anger pressed down hard on it until I have to pause, set down my fork, take a breath. My mother sits quietly. I think of her voice when she told me Josie was dead. I see that her hand is trembling ever so slightly, as if to cover it, as if this is a normal morning with normal things in it. She lifts her cup to drink. "Did you surf?" I nod. We both know it's how I process things, how I make peace, how I live with everything. "Yes," It was gorgeous. She sits in the second chair of the two at the table. Her gaze is fixed on the ocean. Light catches on her serious mouth, and I suddenly remember her laughing with my father, her lips red and wide, as they spun around in a dance on the patio of Eden. Suzanne sober is a far better creature than Suzanne drunk, but I sometimes miss the exuberance of her in those days. "I'll go," I say, maybe hoping to see a whisper of that younger woman. And for a single moment, a flame leaps in her eyes. She reaches for me, and for once I let her take my hand, squeezing it in a fit of generosity. "You promise you'll actually live in my house?" I ask. With her free hand, she draws an X across her heart and raises that same hand in a gesture of an oath. "Promise." "Okay, I'll get out of here as soon as I can arrange it." A wave of mingled anticipation and terror rolls through my chest, sloshes in my gut. Holy shit, what if she's really still alive? "I guess I'm going to have to kill her," Suzanne says.
Chapter 2. Mari. Fingering the blindfold over my eyes, I ask, "Where are you taking me?" My husband, Simon, slaps my hand away. "Leave it alone." "We've been driving forever." "It's an adventure." "Are we going to have kinky sex when we arrive?" "It wasn't previously on the agenda, but now that you've brought it up." He slides a hand up my arm, aiming to wander over my chest, but I swat at him. "I quite fancy the idea of you naked and blindfolded, out in the open." "Out in the open? In Auckland? No. I try to puzzle out clues about our destination. We left the highway a few minutes ago, but I still hear no auditory clues to the neighborhood. Distance traveled might be more of a help if we didn't live all the way in Devonport, a long drive to many other areas of the city. I lift my head to smell the air and catch a whiff of bread. "Ooh, I smell a bakery." Simon chuckles. "That should narrow it down." We ride quietly for a bit. I sip my paper cup of coffee and fret about my daughter, Sarah, who had a breakdown over breakfast, her wild, dark hair falling in a cape over her arms as she protested going to school. She would not say why, only that she hated it, that it was awful, that she wanted to be homeschooled like her strange and prissy neighborhood friend, Nadine. Quite the scene for a 7-year-old who'd previously been the star of her class. "What do you think is going on with Sarah?"
"It's likely a schoolyard spat, but we should go round to the school and talk with them anyway."
"Yes, agreed." Even with her older brother offering to keep an eye on her, she hadn't wanted to go. At age 9, Leo is a mirror image of his father, the same thick, glossy dark hair, ocean-deep eyes, and lanky build. He shows every indication of taking after him athletically as well, swimming like a fish from the age of 6 months. And, like his father, he suffers no dark moods or lack of confidence, unlike Sarah and me. I can't even imagine a life of such calm and sunniness, though I love it in both of them. "She takes after her mother, I'm sorry to say."
"Were you given to moody spills as a child?"
I laugh. The understatement of the century. I pat his hand on the seat, knowing where it will be even with the blindfold. "Some would say I still am."
"Not I. You're perfect."
He squeezes my hand and we turn sharply, bumping into what I presume is a drive. The car angles upward for some distance and then stops.
"You can take off the blindfold now," Simon says.
"Thank God." I rip it away, shaking my hair and smoothing a palm down over it. But the view gives very little away. We're in a tunnel of wild bush made up of tree ferns and vines. An overloaded feijoa tree has dropped hundreds of dark green fruits to the pavement. Where the hell are we? Simon lifts one heavy dark brow, a small grin playing over his generous mouth.
"Are you ready?"
My heart skitters.
"Yes."
He drives forward and upward, upward, the road rutted and neglected, for another minute or two, and then we suddenly emerged from the heavy growth to a wide circular drive, fronting an elegant 1930s house, standing by itself against a backdrop of wild blue sky and sea. The air leaves my lungs, and practically before Simon halts the car, I'm tumbling out of it, mouth agape. Sapphire House. It's a two-story Art Deco mansion overlooking the harbor with its line of islands in the distance. I spin around, and spread out below is the city, glimmering and glinting in the bright morning sunlight. Three of the city's seven volcanoes are visible from here. When I whirl back to look at the house again, my chest squeezes. I've been enchanted by it since I arrived, partly for the tragic story attached to it, but mostly because it sits up on this hill, so elegant and aloof. Untouchable, like Veronica Parker, the murdered film star who built the house for herself in the 30s. Are we going to see the inside? Simon holds up a key. I capture it and fling my arms around his neck. You are the most wonderful man. His palms land on my butt.
I know.
He takes my hand and laces his fingers through mine.
Let's go look.
Did she die?
Last month. You should do the honors.
He pauses in front of the door.
Since it is, after all, yours.
My blood goes ice cold. What are you talking about? He tilts his head back to look at the roofline appraisingly.
I bought it.
His chin lowers.
For you.
His eyes are the color of the Pacific on a stormy day, gray and deep. Right this minute, they shine with delight in his surprise and the direct, open love he carries for me. A line of Shakespeare, lodged in my head from one of the only classes I ever attended regularly in high school, runs through my mind. Doubt thou the stars are fire, doubt that the sun doth move, doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love. I fall into him, forehead against his chest, arms around his waist. God, Simon!
Hey now.
His hands stroke my hair.
It'll be right.
He smells of laundry detergent in our bed and a faint note of autumn leaves. His body is strong and broad, a bulwark against the marauders of the world. Thank you.
There is a slight catch.
I lean back to look up at him.
Yes? Helen, Veronica's sister, had two dogs. Her stipulation was that they came with the house, and there will be a society checking in on them.
I laugh. I kind of love her for that. What kind of dogs?
Not sure. One large, one small, that's what the agent said.
Dogs are no problem. We both love them, and our Golden will be so glad to have the company. Simon nudges me.
Come on, let's go in.
Heart pounding, I unlock and open the door. It swings onto a foyer 2 stories tall, with an airy gallery surrounding it. A skylight pours in great bucketfuls of sunshine on such a bright day. The rooms open out in a circle, and the doors are propped open, offering glimpses of the windows and views. Against the wall of what looks to be the long living room, a row of French doors reveals a staggering view of blue-green sea, sparkling and rolling. Far in the distance, a sailboat bobs by. But inside is even more astonishing. The paintings, the furnishings, the rugs and appointments are all period, mostly Art Deco with its clean, clear lines. A few arts and crafts pieces are mixed in. An exquisite black and red lacquered cabinet holds a carved vase filled with dry stems, and next to it sits a round chair that has almost certainly never been perched upon. The rug is red and gold, with stylized vines. My voice is hushed. Is the whole house like this? So untouched?
I don't know. I haven't been inside.
You bought it sight unseen?
He takes my hand. Let's go look around.
It's a magical wander, practically a museum of the world in 1932. The furniture, the bedding, the walls, and art. The three bathrooms are tiled, and one in particular, the master bath, is such a jewel that I have to do a little dance of delight in the middle of the room. I run my fingers over the understated green and blue tiles that cover the walls, the ceiling, and alcove for the bath. The splendor of the house would be a find even if it were classic Art Deco, but this house was built with a sense of oceanic pride. The stairs are polished cowrie wood, the banister, Australian blackwood. A theme of stylized ferns and kiwis weaves through the accents in woodwork and tiles, and as we move through the hallways and rooms, I trail my fingertips over the precise inlays and carvings, wondering who the woodworker was. French doors with stylized cutouts lead from room to room into a vast patio that looks out to sea. Only three rooms of the 22 have been updated. A bedroom and sitting room at the back of the house, which are an ode to the charmless 70s, and portions of the kitchen, which has a stove and fridge that both look to be about a decade old. The stainless steel appliances clash with the rest of the room, which was designed for a household filled with servants and is suitably vast. The tile work is less spectacular here, but the stove sits in a tiled alcove, and I can see that there might be more buried beneath an unfortunate coat of paint. Simon and I wander back through the butler's pantry, still stocked with everything from fish knives to soup tureens and china in every possible variation. I open one of the glassed doors and take out a bread and butter plate with a dark blue rim on white china, a pattern of jewel lionesses and stylized flowers in gold along the edge. This is incredible. It's like a museum. Carefully, I settle it back in place. Maybe that's what it should be. Maybe it's selfish to want to live here.
Don't be silly, darling.
He tugs me through the narrow room and into the dining room and through one of the French doors in the long line. Look at that. He flings his hand toward the horizon, as if he's painted the view himself.
Imagine our children growing up with this. Imagine that the house finally has life in it.
The breeze ruffles his hair, and I'm drawn, as always, into his vigorous, optimistic view of the world.
You're right. Right.
He pets my shoulder and slides his sunglasses down to his tanned face.
I'm going to take a look at the boathouse and leave you to your explorations. We'll have lunch at Marguerite's, shall we?
Yes, I'd like that, I say. But I'm already drawn back into the house, anxious to put my hands on everything, touch it, make sure it's real. As I walk through the rooms now, touching door jams and walls and artwork and vases, I listen to the atmosphere for anything ghostly or sad, but the rooms are only quiet, hushed, almost, as if waiting. Leaving the master bedroom for last, I explore it all, then move silently up the swirling staircase to the room that occupies fully a third of the second floor. French doors open to a balcony that extends the length of the room, and opposite rise ceiling-high closet doors, sleek and varnished, with discreet chevrons inlaid along the edges. Ghoulishly, I look at the floors, parquet covered with pink and gray rugs. This is where the original owner of the house was found murdered, stabbed to death at the tender age of 28. Veronica Parker, a dark-haired and voluptuous beauty, was a New Zealand lass who'd risen to Hollywood stardom in the mid-20s. In 1932, the Olympics were held in Los Angeles, and Veronica was part of the welcoming committee for the athletes of her country, which is how she met Auckland native George Brown, an Olympic swimmer. A tumultuous love affair began. Veronica had already built Sapphire House, but George was married to his high school sweetheart, who refused to give him a divorce. It was, by all accounts, the undoing of Veronica. The turbulent romance lasted 6 years. On April 9th, 1938, she was found stabbed to death after a party on the hill. Dozens of suspects were interviewed, but everyone was sure it was George who killed her. His world in tatters, he secluded himself for the last 3 years of his life. Some said he died of grief, some of guilt. I toe the floor, wondering, but I can see no signs of foul play. Of course, it was scoured some 80 years before. Still, I find it intriguing that Veronica's sister lived in the house all this time and never slept here. Or not. Who would want to sleep where a sibling had been murdered? Why did she live here, alone, for such a long time? Had she been so grief-stricken that she could find peace only in this house her sister had built? Or was it simply expedient? Not expedient. She could have done 100 other things. Sold the house, made it over onto her own tastes. Instead, she lived in those 3 unassuming rooms, leaving the rest of the house almost exactly as it was when her sister was alive. Except here. Rounding the room, I open drawers and find them empty. The closets are bare. Only the desk, sitting in the corner, holds any artifacts. Yellowed paper and desiccated sealing wax fill one drawer. In another, I find a dried-up bottle of ink and a fountain pen. My fingers curl around the pen, and a shimmer of loss brushes the edges of my throat. The pen is substantial, smoothly inlaid with geometric patterns in green and yellow. Tugging off the lid, I find a carved silver nib. Time slides away. I am 10. Practicing calligraphy with a dip pen as a storm pounds the windows of the bedroom I share with my sister. Her curly hair falls in her face as she bends over her page, meticulously drawing an L, her favorite letter. It's better than mine. Her calligraphy is always better than mine. I drop the pen back in the desk drawer and wipe my hands on my thigh. The house might not be haunted, but I surely am.
Chapter 3. Kit. A couple of days later, I'm boarding a big-bodied Air New Zealand plane, feeling oddly nervous. I haven't traveled a lot, not counting spring break trips to Mexico a few times, so I booked myself a window seat in business class. Since I don't buy anything but surfboards and fountain pens for myself, I also splurged on a juicy Airbnb in a high-rise building in the city center, overlooking the water. That way, if the whole trip is a bust, at least I'll have had a little vacation. Cocooned in the white noise of the engines and the murmuring voices, I find myself falling almost instantly asleep. Inevitably, the dream arrives. It's always the same. I'm sitting on a rock in the cove, with Cinder beside me. I have my arm around him, and he leans against my body. We're staring out to the restless ocean, watching waves that are too big race toward the shore and smash against the rocks that are so dangerous. Spray splashes us all over, but we don't move. In the distance, Dylan is riding his surfboard, not even wearing a wetsuit, but only his yellow and red board shorts. I know he shouldn't be out there, but I just watch him. The wave is too big to safely ride, but he does it. Skates along the center of the curl with his hands out, his fingers trailing in the water in front of him. He's happy, really happy. And that's why I don't want to warn him that the wave is breaking up. And then it throws him, and he disappears into the sea. Cinder barks and barks and barks, but Dylan doesn't surface. The water goes still, and there is nothing to see but silvery ocean all the way to the horizon. I jerk awake, mouth dry, and open the blind to look out at the darkness of endless ocean. The moon is full and shines in a line over the water, far, far below. Stars glitter above, softening the harsh darkness of black sky. A yawning hole pulses in my chest for long moments, but as always, if I am still and focus on something outside of myself, it fades. The only way I survived the losses that marked my early life was by learning to compartmentalize, despite my mother's advice to get some counseling. I'm fine most of the time. But tonight, with the dream fresh in my mind, memories pour in. Me and Josie stealing into the restaurant in the very early morning to pour out the sugar and substitute salt, thinking it so hilarious, until our father lost his temper and spanked us both. The two of us dancing on the Eden patio in my mother's cast-off nightgowns, playing mermaid on the beach or fairies on the bluffs. Later, all three of us moving like a school of fish, Josie and Dylan and me, swimming in the cove or making a bonfire or practicing calligraphy with fountain pens my mother brought back from some trip she took with my father during one of their happy stints. An interest bolstered by Dylan's passion for all things Chinese. Like so many boys of the era, he'd fallen hard for Kwai Chang Kane in the Kung Fu television series. I adored them both, but my sister was first. Worshipped the very air she breathed. I would have done anything she told me. Chased down bandits, built a ladder to the moon. In turn, she brought me sand dollars to examine and Pop-Tarts she stole from the pantry in the house kitchen. And she kept her arms around me all night. It was Dylan who introduced surfing. He taught us when I was 7 and Josie 9. It gave us both a sense of power and relief, a way to escape our crumbling family life and explore the sea. And of course, it was our bond with Dylan himself. Josie. Thinking of her in the times before she turned into the later version of herself, the aloof, promiscuous addict, makes me ache with longing. I miss my sister with every molecule of my being. She changed as an early teen, fighting constantly with our father and rebelling against even the tiniest rule. Not even Dylan could rein her in, though he tried. For all that he acted as an uncle or father figure, he was still only a teenager. She started hanging out with older kids on the beach just north of us. Baby Babe, they called her. Surfer Baby. By then, she was even more beautiful, tiny and tanned to a deep mocha, her blonde hair sun-streaked and endless. Josie, Josie, Josie. At last, I doze again, this time falling into a deep, far-away kind of sleep, and do not awaken until a shaft of light plays on my eyelids. There, below me, is New Zealand. Blue and sinuous in the vastness of the ocean. Little islands dotted all around. And I'm amazed to see both the Pacific and the Tasman Sea. The Tasman looks bluer. The plain banks and drops. And now I can see the coves and cliffs lining the coast. And my heart jolts a little. Is Josie down there somewhere? Or am I on a ridiculous errand? I rest my forehead against the glass, unwilling to take my eyes off the view. Light skitters over the waves, and I remember when my sister and I thought there were jewels in the ocean, dancing on top of each swell. One morning, when we were small, my mother woke us, whispering into the tent where we were sleeping. Josie and me curled together with Cinder. Girls, she called sweetly, wrapping a hand around my foot. Wake up! I found something. The air was thick with fog, but the tide had gone out, leaving ironed flat sand. My mother led us over the path and into a small cave that was approachable only at low tide. Look, she said, pointing. Inside was what looked like a box. Josie bent over, peering into the dimness. What is it? I think it might be treasure, Suzanne said. You should go see. Josie straightened up, crossing her arms. I ain't going in there. I will. Although Josie was 2 years older than me, 7 to my 5, I was always the brave one, filled with a piercing curiosity and a lack of worry over creepy crawlies. I stomped into the cave, bending over to keep from bumping my head. Even in the darkness, I could see the glitter in the box, things spilling over the sides like cartoon booty.
"Treasure!"
I cried and hauled it out to the beach. Suzanne knelt. "I see. Do you think it was pirates?" Digging through the pearls and jeweled rings and bracelets and chocolate coins, I nodded. "Maybe it was mermaids." She unwound a string of sapphires and dropped them around my neck. "Maybe it was," she said. "Now you're wearing their jewelry." I adorned her arm with bracelets. Josie pushed rings onto Suzanne's toes. We drank hot chocolate and sat on the beach in our finery. And we were mermaids with our mermaid mother. The flight attendant snaps me out of my reverie. "Miss, we'll be landing in just a little while." "Thank you." I blink, bringing myself back to now, where that very mother is waiting to hear what I find out about the daughter she lost. For the millionth time, I wonder how to fit the good and the bad of Suzanne into one package. But it's impossible. She was the worst mother of all time. She was the best mother of all time. Below, the city is visible, sprawling across a vast, hilly landscape packed with roofs and streets. With a sudden sense of idiocy, I think this is the very definition of a fool's errand. How in the world will I find a single person in that crowded space, if it's even her? The whole thing is absurd. And yet, I know it isn't. Not really. That was adamantly, absolutely my sister, Josie, on that screen. If she's there, in that city below me, I'm going to find her. By the time I make it to downtown Auckland, I'm so hideously jet-lagged, it's like some evil spell. I'm aware of hauling my bag into the foyer of a high-rise residential apartment building, appointed with nods to an Art Deco past it never had. My suitcase rolls over the marble floors with a whisper, and a young Maori woman in a uniform greets me and then hands over a key and directs me to the elevators. A pair of well-dressed Asian girls passes me, impossibly perfect, and next to them, I am a giantess at 5'10", my curly hair wild from travel. Whatever makeup I left California with disappeared many hours ago. I wish for the protection and credentials of my white coat, reminding the world that I'm a doctor. Pathetic. When the door swings open, a middle-aged couple emerges, cameras in hand, and a good-looking man holds the door open. I give him a nod. "De nada," he says charmingly. I smile faintly as the doors close and rest my head against the wall until I realize I have to press a button. 18. I'm the only person in the elevator and emerge on my floor, find the apartment, and let myself in. For a moment, I'm slightly startled. It's roomy and attractive, with a kitchen to my right, a bathroom to the left, a sitting area with a table and a sofa, and then a bedroom with a balcony, looking out to high-rise buildings and a harbor. But even that doesn't really register. My phone is nearly dead, and I'll have to go find a charger. But right now, I shed my clothes, draw the curtains against the sunlight, and fall into bed. When I climb out of my heavy sleep, I don't immediately know where I am. I'm huddled beneath the covers, curled up against the cold air, but not in my bed. Slowly, I remember everything. New Zealand, my sister, my mom, and poor hobo. Reaching for my phone, I also remember that I don't have a charger and it's dead, so I am not sure what time it is. Without getting out of bed, I reach for the drapes and yank one side open a little. And there, spread like a winking fabric made of jewels, is the harbor. What seems to be late afternoon sunlight slants down in buttery glory, and a sailboat cuts cleanly through the water. A ferry scuds in another direction, and in the distance is a long bridge. Office buildings tower around me. I can see people through the windows, walking briskly down a hall, gathering in a conference room, standing around a table, talking. It's strangely soothing, and I lie where I am for a long while, just watching them. It's my growling hunger that insists I get up. Stretching the kinks of the flight out, I putter into the kitchen area, where there is a bowl of fruit and a French press with a sachet of coffee. Milk in the fridge, a generous size for the space, and sugar packets on the counter. A bright red electric kettle waits. I fill it with water, set it to boil, and head into the shower, which is a luxurious thing, all glass, with fragrant bottles of shampoo and soap. The water revives me better than anything else, and when I emerge, I'm ready to tackle whatever needs doing. The French press is fussier than I'd like, but the coffee is fantastic. And I open the curtains fully to enjoy my view as I scarf down 2 bananas, 2 apples, and the coffee. It'll hold me over until I can get a real meal. The main thing is the charger. I attempted to buy one before I left, but there wasn't much time, and the shop had only European, British, and Japanese. At the front desk, I ask a slim young man for directions, and he points me out the back door to the main drag. Outside, the heat swallows me, a thick, humid envelope. For a moment, I stand just outside the door, suddenly and acutely aware that I'm alone in a city of millions, thousands and thousands of miles from home or anyone I know. I feel a little panicked over the fact that I don't have my phone GPS to guide me around. My brain tosses out all the things that could go wrong. Getting killed by forgetting to look the right way when I cross the street. Veering into an unfriendly neighborhood. Stumbling into the middle of a fight by accident. Not everything is a disaster waiting to happen, I tell myself. Although, strictly speaking, it is. But I'm not going to let that control me. I dived into a university miles from home without a moment's thought. And nobody had maps on their phones in those days. Looking around, I get my bearings and find landmarks. A big open square with steps is filled with well-dressed young Asians and sweaty European tourists. I hear Mandarin and Korean, a snippet of German, English in several accents. The medley settles me, reminds me of San Francisco, where I spent almost a decade between med school and post-grad work. Auckland is like it in other ways, too. Glittery and surrounded by water, crowded and expensive, highly prized. Looking over my shoulder as I set out, I see that my building, which seems to be at least partly residential, is quite distinctive with its Art Deco accents. It will be easy enough to pick it out. Still, I make a note of the address and the street I'm walking along. The man behind the desk directed me to a mall, which leads me through a warren of tiny shops below ground, then spits me out on the busy main drag, Queen Street. Here, overhangs cover the sidewalk, allowing the crowds to bustle along in deep shade, and I'm grateful. The electronics store is exactly like any other I've ever seen, full of gadgets and cases and cords. The counters are staffed by young men and one girl. She steps up. "Hello, ma'am," she says, which makes me feel ancient. "How can I help you?" Her accent is not at all Australian, which I'd been expecting, but something else entirely, more pinched and lilting. "Yes," I pull out my phone. "I need a charger." "American, are you?" "Yes, but they said it doesn't matter, right? A New Zealand charger should still work with my American phone." "No worries." She smiles. Her face is round and milky. "I was just noticing. I'd so love to go to America." She cocks a finger for me to follow her. "Over here." "Where do you want to go in America?" I ask, being polite. "New York City," she says. "Have you ever been?" "Once, for a conference," I say, but it's blurry in my memory. The only thing I really remember is seeing a painting I'd always loved. Here we go. She pulls a package off a rack, holds out her hand for my phone, double checks them both. Yes, this is right. Anything else? No. Eyeing the cords, I realize I'll need one for my laptop too, and tell her the make and model. We head for the cash register, and I give her my credit card. What was the painting? She asks. I'm sorry? She gives me back the credit card. What was the painting you wanted to see in New York? I smile, shaking my head, unwilling to admit it was a pre-Raphaelite mermaid. Waterhouse, do you know his work? No, sorry. She picks up the bag. Have a nice visit. The exchange, really the memory of the painting, makes me think of my sister. Though of course she hasn't been far from my mind for even a minute since I saw her on the news. I'm actually here on a sad errand. Do you happen to know where the nightclub fire was? Someone I knew was there. Oh, her hand covers her mouth. I'm so sorry. It's not far. Just head down toward the wharf and to your left just before the main street. Her cheeks have gone quite red. You can't miss it, really. There's a memorial. I nod. It's as good a place to start as any. She's right. It's not hard to find. The building sits on a corner. Police tape ropes off access on three sides. Smoke marks climb the building to the roofline, black and grim. And I pause for a moment to steady myself. Then I walk around the corner and see the memorial. A pile of stuffed animals and candles and flowers. Some fresh, some turning brown after a few days. There's a smell in the air I associate with burn patients, scorched fabric and hair and blistered skin. Never good. I'd done some reading on the fire before I arrived, but nothing particularly set it apart. It wasn't terrorism, not an issue in New Zealand, hard as that is to fathom. Just a wretched accident, an overcrowded club, a blocked exit, and a malfunctioning sprinkler system. The perfect storm. It only made news in the US for its drama. Disasters are always worse when they involve bunches of young people, and this crowd was very young indeed. I walk slowly past the photos that have been taped and tied and paperclipped to the fence, keeping everyone out. Mostly Asian, not a soul past 30. Their eyes still twinkling with everything ahead and nothing too terrible behind. Now they'll be frozen there forever. The vast losses thud in my gut. The parents who love them, the friends, the siblings, the shopkeepers who enjoyed their jokes. I think about it all the time in the ER, when it's been more ghastly than usual. Idiotic car accidents, domestic violence, and bar fights and shootings. Lives wrecked, stopped. Nothing to be done about it. It's been getting to me. I've always hated losing patients, of course, but I loved the rush of saving them, being there at the moment of acute trauma and terror, and helping bring them back from the brink. Like the girl in the ER the night I saw Josie on the news, a bullet wound to the gut. Her boyfriend carried her in, and his hands were covered with blood from keeping the wound compressed. It saved her. But it's all the lost ones who haunt me lately. The mother who'd slammed her car into a tree. The boy who'd been attacked by a dog. The sweet, sweet face of the little boy who'd shot himself with his mother's pistol. I shove their faces away and focus on bearing witness to the collection of photos here in front of me. Taking the time to look at each one. The girl with purple streaks in her hair and a crooked front tooth. The diva with red lips and a knowing expression. The boy laughing with a dog. How many of their families will have the satisfaction of actual identification? A scene like this, with so many victims and physical damage, can be challenging. The car that took the main blast on the train that supposedly killed Josie was in pieces, melted and evaporated, and so were the humans within. They found her backpack and the remains of one of her travel companions, a guy she'd mentioned once.